My name is Dr. Sarah Metcalf. I'm the Publications Fellow at Australian Family Physician. And today we have the pleasure to chat with Katrina Allen, who is a general practitioner, as well as the Medical Education Coordinator at SHINE, which is the Family Planning Association for Adelaide in South Australia. Welcome, Katrina. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Sarah.
And today we're going to be talking about your recent article for the October issue of Australian Family Physician, and it's entitled Contraception, Common Issues and Practical Suggestions. So really the focus of this article was commonly encountered problems that might complicate contraceptive management, as well as some really helpful tips on facilitating good contraceptive choices, and particularly looking at the group of young women that we see. So, Katrina, we know that the combined oral contraceptive pill is the most common choice for contraception by Australian women. Could you perhaps discuss some of the long-acting reversible contraceptive methods, and also in which patients we can be thinking about these as a first-line option?
Okay, Sarah, thank you. Look, I think that one of the, we go on about it being the pill being the most popular contraception, but sometimes I wonder whether it's just the most popular contraception amongst the GPs that are prescribing it. Because in fact, the studies show that young women, when presented with a long-acting reversible contraceptive method, will very often choose it if it's actually presented in a positive way, and particularly if it's brought up as a first-line choice. And I think that that's one of the things that GPs could be doing a lot more of, is actually saying, well, your contraceptive options are actually, you know, Implanon, Depo, and those sort of more long-acting ones, as well as the pill, or there's also the pill, or that sort of thing. So really putting them first, mainly because, in fact, for a lot of young people, cost is an important factor, and these long-acting ones generally will work out as cost-effective, if not more cost-effective, than the pill. And the other issue is that, of course, they don't have to worry about where their pill packet is. They don't actually have to do anything about it every day. It's there as a set-and-forget method, and for many of them, that's actually a very, very sensible choice. I guess the other side of it, which I didn't emphasise so much in the article, but certainly one of the things that we teach at SHINE is that for young women and indeed young men engaging in sexual activity, the default position should be that contraception is in place, whether or not you've got a sexual relationship. And certainly the countries that have really low unexpected pregnancies and abortions in the teenage group are the ones that counsel contraception in place at all times, such as Belgium and Holland and places like that.
Right.
So I think it's something that we could move up to and really, you know, sort of see if teenagers are involved particularly, or young people generally are involved in sexual activity, then encouraging them to have contraception in place all the time rather than just sort of take the pill when you start a relationship would be a very good thing.
Yeah, and we tend to be a bit more reactive when initiating things in the younger age group, don't we?
If there's
a reason, or perhaps even an unexpected pregnancy, and then following that there's contraception initiated.
That's right. And I think sort of it's a reasonable question to ask of a young person, and it doesn't. There's no evidence that talking about sex or sex education or any of those other things actually increases sexual activity, and there's a lot of evidence that good sexual education actually delays first sexual experience. So I think we ought to take courage from that and see it as something that we do ask teenagers about in a straightforward medical sort of a fashion. And if they are engaging in sexual activities, we encourage them to consider a long-acting method.
Yes. Okay, so if we focus on perhaps a couple of the more common long-acting methods, the contraceptive implant, which is Implanon, and the injection, which is the Depo, Previra or Relivira are the brand names, are there particular issues with these methods that we should keep in mind if we're going to be recommending them?
Well, I think if you've got I mean, depots are one of those ones that I think most GPs would know about. I think for a lot of young women, it's still a very good choice. It's very cost effective, and it does have at least half of its users after the second injection amenorrhea, which is a very welcome effect as far as a lot of young women are concerned. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't cross it off the list. It has to be chosen carefully, but it's still something that I would see as a useful form of contraception. Particularly, you know, the average age in South Australia of first baby is 28. So if you're seeing a 16-year-old, they're going to be using contraception for, you know, 12 years. And so having Depo on board for the first two or three might be perfectly sensible. Just as a sideline on that, on using it in young people, Depo's actually... there has been a question about bone mineral density being affected.
Yeah.
It is a dose-related response to the progestogen, and there's no evidence of any clinical effect. And so the WHO, in their medical eligibility criteria, the MEC, have actually moved it from it being something that they think the risks outweigh the benefits of Category 3. They've moved it back to Category 2, where they see it as something where the benefits outweigh the risks in that younger age group, because it does offer such excellent contraception, and really protection against pregnancy in that age group has been shown to be more important than acceptable protection against pregnancy is more important than the theoretical risks, which haven't been able to be established clinically. So yeah. I think that's an important development. In relation to Implanon, I think, first of all, to remind your listeners that the introducer has actually changed. It's now a stapler rather than a horse needle, so it's less frightening for the young women who go into the chemist and they're shown this massive thing. I work in the country and they'd all come in and say, blimey, that's a horse needle, isn't it? And it's also easier to insert. So from the GP's point of view, it may be something that you're more than confident to take up now. The other thing about it is that it does produce irregular bleeding, and that is its major disadvantage and its major side effect. So you do need to counsel reasonably carefully. We try and mosey young women through the first 3 months, sort of use things like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which are really often quite successful in diminishing, if not stopping, the bleeding. As with all other methods, such as giving them a sample of the pill or anything else like that, most of them are reasonably successful. However, none of them predict when the bleeding's going to come back. So you can often stop the bleeding that's occurring, but you can't reassure them that once you've stopped it, it's going to stay stopped. And you will get some women that just goes on bleeding, and, you know, they're the ones that you take it out and try another method. But if they haven't been counselled that this is going to happen and, you know, come back to outrage that they've had a couple of days of bleeding outside of their cycle, you really missed the boat, because, you know, they should have had a chance to accept that as a very, well, an inevitable side effect, really.
Yes. That's right. And if it's a pattern that they can live with, then it can work very well. Yeah.
And quite often, you know, I do think it's quite reasonable to say to them, look, try and last out the first 3 months or so, because it's often settling in. What we do know is that at 6 months, if they're still getting very irregular bleeding, that pattern is relatively less likely to change. So if I get them still at 6 months with, you know, 2 to 3 week periods and that sort of thing, I'm usually saying to them, look, we'll probably need to consider taking this out.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And then intrauterine devices are being considered more frequently in younger age groups these days. Could you perhaps take us through some points to consider for GPs who are thinking about recommending these to younger patients, or indeed GPs that insert them in their practices?
Well, for those who are inserting them in their practices, I'd have to say good on you. At Shine, it's just very interesting. I was at a meeting of IUD inserters recently, all GPs and Shine workers, and basically, you know, said, well, who's inserted it in an under 20-year-old? And virtually all of the audience put their hand up. You know, by the time we were down to 15-year-olds, there were only two of their hands still up. But, you know, it was just a very interesting reflection. I think none of us are talking about it because it's not something that we used to be doing, but we are finding, complicated situations where people have got odd bleeding disorders or, sort of particularly desperate circumstances, and we end up agreeing. I have to say, it would be relatively rarely that as a GP, I would recommend an IUD in an under 20-year-old. What usually happens is that people turn up, young women turn up and say, look, I've looked at all of the options and I want an IUD. And then I say, well, surely you realise that, you have to have an internal, it causes cramping and blah, blah, I go on the back foot immediately and try and put them off because I think, well, they've read it, like lots of things on the internet, they've read it and they really haven't got a clue. And very often it turns out that actually I'm doing them a disservice. They've actually looked at everything. They've often tried a couple of other methods. And for various reasons, it is actually a perfectly sensible choice. I personally would be relatively less likely to recommend it in the sort of particularly 18 and under. However, I work as a GP obstetrician up at Mount Barker, and we've got quite a few women in their early 20s who've had a couple of kids, don't want any more immediately, and, in those young women, IUD is a perfectly sensible choice, and I probably would offer it to them. So you do have to pick it, and it's not, the age and the nulliparity is no longer an absolute contraindication. It's one of those things that I think we're becoming a little bit freer about. Bayer's talking about bringing out the Mini Mirena, which is a smaller device. Unfortunately, I think it's only going to last for 2 or 3 years. Whether the smaller device is actually going to be that much more use. I mean, I guess in practice what we're finding is that it's not always that much more difficult to put an IUD in a 20-year-old nullip than it is a 35-year-old nullip. And, of course, the 35-year-old nullips are wanting it for menorrhagia, or the 45-year-old nullips. And, of course, there's more and more of them. So the population is changing. And I guess within that we're changing our practice, but we're not necessarily doing that in a public space.
Yeah, right. And what about the concept of the risk of infection with an IUD in a younger person who's perhaps not got one partner?
Yeah. Look, I think that's an issue, but the important thing to remember about that is that the risk related to the IUD is actually only around the IUD insertion.
Yes, okay.
20 days after the insertion, the risk of PID, which is obviously the thing that you're really wanting to avoid, actually drops back to the background risk. So, and if you've got a teenage sex worker who you've treated twice for chlamydia, then I would be very reluctant because her background risk of PID is quite high. But in a sense, you're not going to alter that. It seems to be that the process of breaking the seal between the outside and the inside and putting in the IUD is the thing that precipitates a pelvic inflammatory disease or pelvic infection that goes on to pelvic inflammatory disease associated with the insertion. Right. At any other time, it's actually a chance thing that occurs with a infection that then ascends into the reproductive tract that isn't associated with the IUD being present or not being present, basically. And what we say at Shine, and what we do at Shine, because we see a lot of people who come in just for their IUD insertion, so we don't have a background history on them, we ask for a current smear test that's normal. And the reason we ask for that is because if they need treatment, then you're going to have to take the IUD out. So you might as well know that before you start. And then we also get a high vaginal swab and a chlamydia PCR, chlamydia and gonococcus PCR, just simply so that we're not inserting into a situation where there's already an active infection.
Yes.
And we would be reluctant to proceed without that information. Now, in your own practice, there might be certain circumstances in which you don't feel you need that information. But at Shine, we tend to be fairly keen to be operating within those parameters.
Yes. Okay. And in terms of the case where there is an infection post-insertion, obviously treated with antibiotics as per local guidelines.
Yeah, that's what we generally say to people.
Yeah.
I mean, what we generally say to the woman we've done the insertion in is, and this is what I think GPs really need to know, because there's more and more of them out in the community and they're more and more likely to turn up at, you know, 6:30 on Friday evening just as you're leaving with a malodorous discharge and, you know, feeling a bit off. You need to do an internal. You need to see if there's cervical excitation or any tenderness in the eccnexi, which would be the presumptive diagnosis of pelvic infection.
Yeah.
And then you would treat, and we generally say find out from your local your local infectious diseases clinic, general infections VD clinic, what their current recommended treatment for pelvic infection is. And generally it would be something like doxycycline, metronidazole, or something like that.
Yeah.
Treat them aggressively. You don't need to remove the IUD. You just need to treat the infection, and then you need to review them after a short period of time, which is usually a few days, and make sure that the signs that you elicited, the cervical excitation, the eccnexial tenderness, has actually diminished. And if you can see that the infection's gone, then, in fact, they can go ahead with the IUD.
Know that you don't have to automatically remove it in that.
No. No, that's right. I mean, obviously, if you had ongoing evidence of PID, then you'd have to think about what you were going to manage then. But in most cases, if you've just got the infection and not the disease, then if you treat it promptly and aggressively and check that it has responded to the treatment, you should be able to leave the IUD in.
Right. Okay. And obviously, Katrina, a discussion on contraception wouldn't be complete without chatting about the combined oral pill. So what do you see as the main pitfalls with the use of this method, and particularly, again, in the younger age groups?
Well, I think that the first thing I really worry about is cost, because it has to be a sustained method, really. As I say, most of these young women are going to be using it for a decade. And so I really strongly encourage GPs to consider the generic preparations, particularly for people who are on healthcare cards. I know it's very seductive to give them a free sample of the latest one that the reps come around with. But, you know, you'll find it very difficult to then move them onto Monofem or Noramin, or, you know, one of the generics, having settled them on Yaz or Yazflex or whatever.
Yes, and so over many years that gets very expensive.
Oh, yes, enormously expensive. I mean, they're paying 10 times what they need to pay if they're on a healthcare card. So I think that would be the thing that I'd really ask GPs to think about carefully. Within that, I think there are a few things to be, you know, just sort of, it's just really simple stuff, like often when it's initiated, the fairly large dose of hormones can cause nausea and headaches and that sort of thing, and just taking the pill in the evening is a really simple way of decreasing the effect of the medication as it rises in the bloodstream, because
yeah.
they'll be asleep. So, and it doesn't mean that they have to take it forever in the evening, but often if you even can get them to do it for the first 3 or 4 weeks, they'll adjust to the medication and it'll all be quite straightforward.
Yeah,
so simple stuff.
Say, very simple thing, but often perhaps not thought of.
Yeah. And the other thing I usually do is I get them to come back. Like I explain I can give them a year's prescription of the pill, because, of course, they know from their friends they can get a year's prescription of the pill. But I say, look, I want you back at the end of 2 or 3 months, and I'll give you the year then. I want to recheck your blood pressure at that point, and I'll also just check and see whether you're happy with it or not. Because if you don't reinforce it, one of the major problems with the pill is that people just don't, you know, they start taking it and then they stop. And so I think a little bit of attention early on, and what you'll get is somebody who turns up once a year with a perfectly straightforward rescript. But you do need to sort of put in a little bit more effort at the beginning.
Yeah, to set up good patterns. And I know you mentioned that research has sort of shown that linking of behaviours is a good way
yes.
to help people to take it.
And, you know, just sort of, that a lot of young people have very chaotic lives, but most of them, you know, clean their teeth at night or, you know, sort of brush their hair in the morning or those sort of things, and trying to sort of say, look, think about it. When you're brushing your teeth, think, I'm brushing my teeth, I'll take my pill. I'm brushing my hair, I'll take my pill, whatever it happens to be, you know, linking something that they would do under, you know, almost all circumstances can just help them make it into a pattern.
Yeah, okay. And another interesting point that you made was that the product information that comes with various contraceptives is not actually always aligned these days with current practice,
That's right.
In terms of how we advise women to take the pill and also for potential interactions. So could you sort of give us an outline of what, you know, current evidence is advocating in these areas?
Sure. I mean, one of the most problematic things about the product information sheets is that it says to start on some preparations. It says start in the red section, and in fact, what that would do would be start them taking the pill in the section that's actually the sugar tablet, so it means nothing.
Yeah.
And what we know now is that if you start the hormonal pills day one to day five, where day five's the where day one's the first day of bleeding, then in fact the pill will work immediately. If you follow the directions on some of the most common pills, and particularly Levlen, you actually would, if you start on day one and your period happens to start on a Monday, you could take five sugar tablets, and actually only starting the active tablets on the sixth day, which means that it wouldn't work immediately.
And then you've got to wait the 7 days.
7 days, that right? And of course,
yeah,
that's completely confusing and counter to much of the information that we give about taking the pill. So what I usually do is I actually get the pill, and any of your drug reps will actually give you a swatch of the different types of pills on the market at the moment, and just getting them out. And it doesn't matter which one it is. You can point out which are the active tablets and which are the hormonal, which are the inactive tablets, so the hormones and the sugar tablets, and just simply say, start at the beginning of the large group of hormone tablets and take, you know, from that beginning and work your way through. And by the time you come, if you start that between day one and day five of your menstrual cycle, where day one's the first day of bleeding, then you'll be immediately covered for contraception.
Mm.
So, you know, it's that thing of sort of making it completely clear. And you can use the leaflets. The family planning organisations have pretty good leaflets on that, the Shine leaflet, at our website, www.shinesa.org.au. Leaflets will give you a leaflet on the pill and explain how to start and that sort of thing, and what to do with missed pills and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
I guess the other thing I'd mention in relation to taking pills is to simply say that antibiotics do not affect the pill.
Mm.
And I guess I'd underline that and put that in neon because it's such a pervasive belief held by both the public and also by GPs. The only antibiotic that affects the pill is rifampicin, and it affects the pill because it's a liver enzyme inducer, not because it's an antibiotic. There was a long-standing theoretical concern that because particularly the penicillins and the tetracyclines and the cephalosporins affect gut flora, that they would affect the uptake of estrogen. But there's been both experimental evidence and also epidemiological evidence to suggest that, to show conclusively, not just suggest, but show conclusively that this effect is minimal, and it certainly doesn't oppose the anovulatory effect of the pill. So it's just really important.
Yeah.
You know, for people to remember that, because it's very confusing, and women think, I've made a mistake, and they stop taking the pill.
Yes, it seems to be the default position, isn't it?
That's
which
right.
Really, you just want them to keep going.
Yeah, and that would be another thing I'd say, particularly to young people, is just keep taking it. You know, if you've got any uncertainties, go on taking the pill and talk to somebody about it. Don't stop and wait a week and then talk to somebody.
Okay, and so I guess just to summarise what we've chatted about today, Katrina, when we're talking about contraceptive choices with young women, what are the major points you think it's important for GPs to consider?
Well, I guess, you know, I'd go back to underlining considering long acting methods that are set and forget, because I think that that's a really appropriate thing for young people. I'd also really emphasise considering in the context of the individual you're seeing the cost,
yes,
because that may well affect both the efficiency and the duration of action, because if they can't afford it, then in fact it's going to turn out to be a very inefficient method, and they're not going to be able to apply it for long. And I don't think it's emphasised enough. We tend to sort of look at the medical side of things. And if you're not sure about how to apply some of the long-acting methods, then a lot of the family planning organisations will run courses or information evenings or that sort of thing that will update you quite quickly, or even just reading their websites will give you the information that you need to be able to encourage young people to use those sort of methods. I guess there's one other point I'd put in that's not really a part of the summary, but something that we know is that a lot of young people are using long-acting contraception, using the pill continuously. So they're not taking the hormone, they're not taking the sugar tablets. And this is widely recognised as a clinical phenomenon. It's advised in some medical circumstances, but if you talk, apparently about a third of university students who are taking the pill are doing just this thing. And I guess the most useful thing that's emerging clinically is that this will quite often be associated with irregular bleeding. That's not when, because they're not taking the sugar tablets, they're just taking continuous hormone tablets, and they will get bleeds occasionally, either because the endometrium's too thick or the progestogen will also actually thin the endometrium out so that it's fragile. So it can be either of those two reasons usually. And what the current advice clinically is, if you've got somebody like that, they're extremely unlikely to be doing themselves any harm or disadvantage. But if they bleed for more than 4 days, the endometrium is likely to be significantly disrupted. And the sensible thing to do is to stop taking the pill for 4 days. So just take a 4-day break and then pick it back up again. So what you do, you'd be bleeding for 4 days, it hasn't stopped, stop taking any pills or take the sugar tablets for 4 days.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on how you're managing things.
Yep.
And allow the endometrium to stop having a hormonal effect. But
yeah,
obviously you also minimise the chance of decreasing your ovulation control.
Yes, right. Well, that seems a good strategy, because certainly, yeah, we do get a lot of patients coming to us with those sorts of queries.
Mm.
So.
Yeah, yeah. And I think having a, you know, that's what's emerging from the consensus amongst the family planning doctors, is that the 4 days of bleeding can be followed by 4 days, which obviously you'll get more bleeding. So you'll, in effect, you'll get 8 to 10 days of bleeding. But
yeah,
you should have cleared the endometrium out, you should have restarted, and hopefully you'll get another long stretch where you don't get any bleeding.
Yes, fantastic. Okay, well, that's fantastic, Katrina. Really, really helpful tips and hints. And obviously we can direct people to the state-based family planning,
yes,
organisation,
yeah,
websites, because every state has one.
That's
and,
right.
And they've got various resources on there. That's a really good place to start for further information.
That's right. And they've almost always got some telephone lines. You know, people are they've got sexual health lines and that sort of thing, or even just the local number. They've often got clinicians who are willing to answer questions pretty well immediately, or post them on the website. So if people aren't sure, use the resources locally and you'll almost certainly get a useful answer.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for your time today, Katrina. That was really,
no worries,
really
Sarah.
Helpful.
Okay. It's been a pleasure. Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.